Philippians 4, verse 11. Listen to the voice of a 60-something Christian activist who has lost the freedom to work and minister, who's chained to a soldier in an isolation unit in Rome, who's existing at subsistence level, who's facing a trial before Nero, which may end in execution, and who's probably in the saddest chapter of his life. Philippians 4:11. I have learnt to be content, whatever the circumstances. Or verse 12, I've learnt the secret of being content in any and every situation. Paul on contentment. That's where we are tonight. And he's not on the subject for the first time. 2 Corinthians 12:10, he talks about weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions. And then he says, for the sake of Christ, I am content. Wow, what? You're content with that? You may need counseling. Or 1 Timothy 6, 6-8. Godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Or the writer to the Hebrews on the same theme, Hebrews 13:5. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. Because God has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. Contentment. Gospel contentment. It's an apostolic non-negotiable. And yet, for so many of us, so much of the time, frankly, it's a bit of a mirage. A fairy tale. If only you knew me, you say, I have learnt the secret of being discontent in any and every situation. Some of you will know or have read Joni Erickson Tada. She'll be 70 this year. She's one of the most powerful exponents of godly contentment I know. In 1967, at 17, she dived into Chesapeake Bay and broke her back. And she was left quadriplegic. She's been to All Souls. Years back, I had to preach on contentment of all things on the very Sunday she visited unexpectedly. I stood here banging on about contentment, feeling off the scale, not content, while Johnny sat over there in her wheelchair with a gracious smile. It was a nightmare. But 50 years after her accident, Johnny said in an interview, there really are more important things in life than walking. There are more important things than having the use of your hands, and that is having a heart that's free of the grip of sin and pride and self-centeredness. That's God-glorifying gospel contentment. And it all sounds incredible in a culture that idolizes physical ability, where the fit and the beautiful and the successful have it all. And we want some of that, don't we? And the ill and the depressed and the feeble are our greatest embarrassment. In our, there's an app for that society, we're shocked at what we can't control. We resent hardship. We're entitled to better, more, easier. We deserve to be happy, don't we? We're a bit special. In our culture, contentment often seems in short supply. It's a bit of a lost art. And contentment is elusive because sin is pervasive. And discontent fuels our society. And Brexit, you know, is perhaps our very own little expression of the age of discontent. In the latest Edelman's annual trust survey, only 14% of Britons felt that the country works for them. Our children, said to be some of the least happy in Europe. Our students are apparently swamping university counselling services. Our psychiatric clinics are seeing more and more self-harm and adolescent disturbance. And the churn of discontent seems everywhere as we struggle to function in often what feel like concentric circles of insecurity, where we worry about our lives and our livelihoods, our finances, our families, our nations, the planet. Life in the world defies contentment, it seems. Paul Dolan, the professor of behavioral science at LSE, wrote a book last year with a good title. Happy Ever After, he said, escaping the myth of the perfect life. And his big idea is that the traditional definitions of happiness are, in truth, traps of misery. Work harder, work more, earn more, buy more, move upward, look better, find a perfect partner. Happiness, he argues, writing from an entirely secular perspective, doesn't lie in that direction at all. We need to move, he argues, from a culture of more please to one of just enough. The Resolution Foundation recently surveyed the happiness and contentment levels of 1 million Britons based on Office for National Statistics research. And the bad news is it's downhill most of the way from 16 until you get to around 51 when apparently things begin to pick up. And by 70, they concluded, you'll find things are as good as they're likely to get. Incidentally and encouragingly, that survey revealed that being a member of the clergy emerged as giving the greatest contentment and inspiration, I trust, to lots of you to think of ordination. Now, of course, as Christian people, look, we don't float above the mud and the mess and the pain of life, stoically relegating disappointments and trials and tragedies to some sort of back room in our lives. Discontent can strike at any time. Yes, we hear bosses say, we'll have to let you go. Or doctors say, it's cancer. Or spouses say, it's over. Or tutors say, you've got to resit. Or authorities say, your church is banned. We sow in tears. Psalm 1265. In the world we face tribulation, John 16:33. We weep with those who weep, Romans 12:15. So I want to know what Paul is talking about when he speaks of a whatever the circumstances kind of commitment. I want to get that. It's relatively easy to be content when things are going swimmingly. I want to know a contentment that isn't blown away by the shattering phone call or the frightening diagnosis, that holds up when I'm shaking my fist at God and saying inwardly, what were you thinking about, Lord? Is this the best you can do for me? Do you really expect me on the basis of this to turn up Sunday after Sunday and tell everyone how great you are? Jeremiah Burroughs, the Puritan preacher and one of the contributors to the Westminster Assembly, which later produced the Westminster Confession, wrote a wonderful little book published in 1648, which is really an extended reflection on our text, and he entitled it The Rare Jewel of Christian Contentment. It's incredibly readable. And he says our Philippians text is, to quote him, the very life and soul of all practical divinity. Contentment, he argues, is ultimately soul business. A sweet, inward, heart thing. A work of the Spirit, he says, indoors. And that's where we need Paul's help most, for contentment works inside out. Burroughs defines Christian contentment as, and again I quote, that sweet, inward, gracious frame of spirit which freely submits to and delights in God's wise and fatherly disposal in every condition. Or as we might put it in more modern language, a deep satisfaction with the will of God. Proverbs 3:5 says it all so simply that it's revolutionary, so counterculturally it will transform your life. You know Proverbs 3:5? Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. It's big. And yes, of course, it's a mystery, Philippians 4. It's a mystery, or a secret, as Paul says in verse 12. But what a relief that it can also be learnt. Do you see that in verse 11? It can be learnt. Isn't that an encouragement? There's hope for you and me. Contentment is not innate to Christian experience. You don't trust Jesus and suddenly get content. You're not a restless rebel one minute and a completely contented person the next. And yes, of course, there's a certain kind of contentment which comes immediately you become a Christian. And it's a wonderful thing. But there are contentment battles to fight too, and they're lifelong. Paul had to learn how to be content. So if you're a Christian not living in a state of contentment, join the club. This chapter's great news. Well, let's look at what it has to say. Look, I can't give you all the answers. I can't answer some of my own questions, let alone yours. But there's something better than knowing all the answers, and that is knowing and trusting the one who does know the answers and who will never leave us or forsake us. So let's look at some contentment themes that bubble up in this lovely chapter as Paul spells out at least six strands in the fabric of contentment. Now look, there's only time for the headlines. And here's the first. One, he had confidence in the providence of God. Well, you know the context of the book. We've talked about that before. 10 years have gone since Paul ministered in Philippi, the first church in Europe. And they'd loved him from the beginning, chapter 1, verse 5. And more recently, the church had heard that he was in real difficulty and had dispatched Epaphroditus with gifts, verses 17 and 18, probably money and food and clothing to ease the pressure. And he is profoundly moved by their concern, verse 10. And in this section, he writes to say thank you. But he also wants, rather subtly, to signal that this letter is no plea for more. You know those sort of charity letters we get. Thank you for your generous donation. The work continues to grow, and we hope that we may count on your continuing support, i.e. send more. No, he wants to signal he's fine. He's got enough. He's not asking. He's grateful. He's content. And there's a clue there at the end of verse 10. Did you notice it? It's really just a word. It just sneaks into the passage. He knows the 10-year gap in their interaction with him was explicable. He knows they were concerned, but then he adds, you had no opportunity. And it's an unusual kairos word, only used here in the whole of the New Testament. And the reason Paul says you couldn't help earlier, he implies, was because it simply wasn't God's moment. He didn't make it happen. And that thinking takes us to the very baseline of all biblical contentment, confidence in the providence of God. The reason Paul is content and not frustrated is that he has a patient confidence in God's sovereign providence. That's where all contentment starts. He knew all his times and seasons and opportunities were in God's good hands. God is not disconnected, you know, from a single thing that's happening in the world. Paul knew that. So there's no panic in his heart. There's no need to manipulate people. There's no need to put on the thumbscrews for money or anything else. There's just a steady confidence that God, in due time, would order circumstances so that his need would be met. Now, until you come to a place in your life where you understand that God is sovereignly ordering everything about your life for his own holy purpose and his glory and your ultimate good, you don't get gospel contentment. Here's where it begins. I am the focus of his omniscient love. I'm not forgotten. He knows the number of hairs on my head. He understands every detail of my life. He maybe even puts my tears in a bottle. He orders everything in his universe to bring about my ultimate good. Think Joseph. Think Job. Think Ruth. Think Esther. Genesis 50, verse 20. You intended to harm me. God intended it for good. See, discontent comes when we try to control everything. And that's usually the result of a failure to understand that everything is already under control. And somebody better than you is running it. See, we're designed to run on trust. And trust is simple, but it's not easy. And the issue is not, do you nod your head to the providence of God? You know, you've heard about it, you believe the doctrine. The question is, can you get it into your heart and soul so that it dominates all your circumstances? He's in charge. He's in charge. You can have confidence that the circumstances you experience now are the ones God has determined are best for you. And equal confidence that one day you will see how this is so. See, there are no wasted hardships, friends, with God. Jesus is in charge of today as he is of every day. Here's a second theme. He was satisfied with the provision of God. Look at verses 11 to 13. This is a whatever the circumstances. It's an in any and every situation kind of contentment. And this contentment handles, verse 12, need and plenty, being well fed or hungry. It works in both situations. It's life lived independent from circumstances. Doesn't ebb and flow with the vicissitudes of life or my turbulent feelings. It's not a personality thing. It's not about the accumulation of stuff. It's not related to what you have or what you don't have. It's okay when things are going well and when they're not. For Paul, it was great to be hugged and extolled and admired, but it was great too to be beaten and bruised and battered. For those things can't stop the contentment of God. For here's another lesson. Contentment is non-circumstantial. If you're after God contentment, gospel contentment, the second thing you learn is it's non-circumstantial. Now, Paul never denies hard circumstances. He's simply content, satisfied with God's providential care. And that may mean, at the moment, he has very, very little, objectively speaking. It's pretty awful. Be content with what you have, says Hebrews 13:5. Are there six more terrifying words in a culture like ours? And that word content, interestingly, is the same word as the word Paul uses in 2 Corinthians 12:9, where he hears Jesus say of the thorn in the flesh, "My grace is sufficient for you." Content people believe, not just in the providence of God, but in the sufficiency of grace to cover any deficit in us. And that's really verse 13, our third point. He was sustained by the power of God. I can do all this through him who gives me strength. In Paul's day, the Stoic philosophers taught that people could and should achieve through sort of willpower, a self-sufficiency, an emotional detachment that could insulate them from life's turbulence. Contentment was one of their big words, and it's exactly the word that Paul uses and sort of gives a Christian flavor to here. The Stoic said, contentment comes from you know, master of your fate, all that sort of stuff. And that's what our culture says to us as well. And the very word Paul chooses to turn their thinking on its head, to Christianize it, he uses to say, no, it doesn't. It doesn't come from you. What matters is not self-sufficiency here, but Christ's sufficiency. Contentment comes not from focusing on ourselves and feasting on stuff, but through focusing and feasting on Jesus. He's the one, the only one, who's good for and every circumstances kind of commitment, contentment. Verse 13 has been a gravely abused text, a sort of slogan of personal empowerment, a kind of motivating motto for achievement or prosperity. But look at its context. Paul is saying, look, I can do depths and heights. I can do rich and poor. I can do hungry and filled. All this, not because I'm a sophisticated, well-thought-through guy. I can deal with it all. I can get through it simply because I have the strength Jesus gives. He's enough. He's the treasure that trumps them all. And the roots of any real all-circumstances contentment are found in him alone. And what's striking about this verse is not that we can achieve anything we wish for, but that God enables self-centered people to find their identity and their joy and their purpose in trusting him rather than in themselves. He really is all you will ever need for God-glorifying contentment. And frankly, how often is it when we're at breaking point that we really do come to know him as our rock, when we run out of our own resources and our own ability to sort things out? Isn't that the time we find his strength is there to get us through time after time? God's economy, we flourish when our need for him is met in him. And there's no circumstance in our lives that he's not using to grow us. There's no need that we have that he won't fill with himself. And there's nothing we truly need that's not found in Christ. When we want, we're given more of Christ. When we suffer, our solidarity with him grows. God is more interested, you know, in our holiness than in our comfort. Elizabeth Elliot, the American writer, has a great line. The secret of joy is Christ in me, not me in different circumstances. Here's a fourth theme. He savored the peace of God. Do you know that old quip? I remember hearing it in a sermon from Michael Lawson when he was on the staff here. One of the funny, you hold these things in your mind for decades. When in a fix, Philippians 4:6. And Paul knows, you know, that for most of us, the monster of anxiety, of worry, that's the thing, isn't it, that daily wrecks our contentment? Because that monster assures us that everything is wrong and nothing is right. And if it can go badly, it almost certainly will. And most of us, and I include myself, are wretched worriers. And it assaults our faith and it destroys our peace and sometimes it even wrecks our health. And of course, the moment you're told by some speaker to stop worrying, you promptly begin to worry about not worrying. So yes, Paul says, verse 6, don't be anxious about anything. Boy, that sounds a bit comprehensive. But he immediately provides a clear alternative strategy. That's what makes the difference. In every situation, he says, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. The way to be anxious about nothing, he says, is to be prayerful about everything. Switch your worry list to a prayer list. And do it with a humble, non-demanding, and thankful mindset. Ruth Graham, the wife of Billy, used to tell a story of an anxious, weary Christian who lay awake at night with the cares of the church and the world swirling in his mind. And one night he heard the Lord gently say to him, "Now you go to sleep, Jim. I'll sit up." See, once you get this, and once you pray with a heart that's thankful for everything God designs for us, the pleasures and the pain, then verse 7, his peace will guard our hearts and minds and free us from anxiety in a way that defies mere rational explanation. It, as he puts it beautifully, transcends all understanding. Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pains we bear, all because we do not carry everything to God in prayer. See, so much to do with contentment is in the mind, what we're thinking about. I haven't got time now, but I wish we'd longer to unpack that menu for the mind, which he gives in verses 8 and 9. Do you see that? The contentment outcome, though, is exactly the same. End of verse 9. I promise that the God of peace will be with you. Life offers nothing better than that. Here's a fifth theme. He prioritized the people of God. Have you ever thought that your local church has a primary role in your personal pursuit of contentment? Here's the bottom line. The church is the most important organization on the planet. It exists to equip us to fulfill the highest calling on the planet, to glorify God and help people know and follow Jesus. So there's nothing more noble or significant you can ever be involved in, and more important than any career or material success that you'll ever have. And if contentment is about whether or not you rest and rejoice in the sufficiency of the Trinity, or you fall for the deceptive marketing of the world, whether you fasten your heart on people and stuff, or you're content with God, well, where's all this going to be worked out? Where are you going to get a handle on all this? Answer, in your church, where the gospel is seen and applied. Philippians is full of fellowship priority. And the whole book is stuffed with church stuff. Joy in relation to other people. Verse 1, he loves and longs for his fellow Christians. Verses 2 and 3, he's concerned about some pastoral spat between two powerful women in the church. Verse 10, he's been the beneficiary of their tangible support and love and their gifts. Verse 17, he's longing that even their generosity will be credited to their spiritual account. Verse 19, that their needs will be met according to Christ's riches. Contentment comes from cultivating the needs of others. It's not all about us. It's about giving your life away. Discontent is so often the product of self-preoccupation, isn't it? It's not all about me. And the church, you know, is the best place in the world to work all that out. 41 years ago tomorrow, I was standing on this very spot getting married to Jean. And that has contributed more to my contentment than I can ever tell you. But, you know, being part of the life of All Souls now for nearly 5 decades has come a very, very close second. Never for a moment underestimate what truly throwing yourself into the life of a good church will do for your contentment. Paul has no doubt of that. And then sixth and finally, he stands on the promise of God. Verse 19, what a terrific sentence to end on. It's personal, my God. It's positive, we'll meet. It's pointed, your needs. It's plentiful according to the riches of his glory. It's powerful in Christ Jesus. And behind all this are what I might call the macro truths of Christian contentment. First, God's power. Sparrow can't fall to the ground apart from him. Not a hair can fall from my head without his will. He created and sustains all things by his powerful word. God will not drop the ball of my life or yours when it really counts. His power, his love, it's steadfast, loyal, faithful, unchanging. It never fails. It comes to its apex in Jesus. No wonder Paul can exclaim in Romans 8:32, "He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things?" His power, his love, his wisdom, God knows what he's doing. Do you doubt that? His powerful love flows in the deep channels of his wisdom. That consoles me. Like Job, I can entrust myself to him even when my finite perspective is calling foul. And then finally, his presence. He's with me. He's there. He's near. He's attentive. This is perhaps the best comfort of all. I'm not alone. Sometimes, you know, we can get power and love and wisdom, but we feel it's all being operated at a distance by a sort of absentee father. And yet one of the most precious realities in the Bible is that our God is with us. Psalm 23, verse 4, "Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and staff comfort me. The good shepherd never leaves us. And one day we'll see him face to face." What a prospect. Well, may the Lord help each of us get hold of some of these profound truths of Christian contentment. Let's be quiet for a moment as we close. Let me pray. Lord, help every one of us here to rest in your power, to know your love, to trust your wisdom, and to experience your nearness, that we may be your people and live to your glory. Lord, give us Paul's confidence in the providence of God, his satisfaction with the provision of God, a sense of being sustained by the power of God. Help us to savor the peace of God, to prioritize the people of God, and above all, to stand on the promises of God. We ask it for your glory. Amen.